This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iraq condemns U.S. airstrikes on its territory, an act of aggression that's claimed at least 16 lives, injured dozens more in the Arab country. Meanwhile, Damascus denounces American attacks on Syria, emphasizing attacks undermine the country's capacity to combat Daesh terrorists. And a genocidal campaign led by the U.S. and Israel in Gaza reaches its 120th day, with the death tolls now exceeding 27,200, majority of them women and children. U.S. says it's carried out airstrikes on 85 targets inside of Iraq and Syria. This after Washington pledged to respond to a deadly drone strike on its troops in Jordan. U.S. Central Command claims targets include rocket, missile, and drone depots. The U.S. president says that the strikes will continue at the time and place of Washington's choosing. However, Joe Biden says the U.S. is not looking for conflict in West Asia. Washington's confirmed deaths of three of its forces in the drone strike that hit its military base last weekend in Jordan. An Iraqi resistance group has claimed responsibility. It marks the first time U.S. military personnel have died in an attack since the start of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza on the 7th of October. And now strong reactions to U.S. attacks are streaming in from regional countries, not least by Iraq and Syria themselves. Iraq has condemned the strikes near its western border with Syria as a violation of its sovereignty. It warned that the attack, which claimed the lives of 16 people, including civilians, will have disastrous consequences for Iraq and the region. Syria, meanwhile, says aggression caused casualties among civilians and soldiers and inflicted heavy material damage on the eastern part of the country. It added, this is the same region where Syrian forces are battling remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group, and this proved U.S. collusion with the terrorists. Said the U.S. seeks to undermine the capability of the Syrian army and its allies in combating terrorism. Iran's also strongly denounced the strikes as another strategic mistake by the U.S. It said attacks serve Israeli interests and further embroil the U.S. in the region. Joining us now from Osaka is Ryan Dawson, geopolitical analyst, for more on the story. Hello, Ryan. Hope you're doing well out there in Japan. And now, Ryan, your thoughts on the U.S. Time and again saying it's not looking to get itself basically involved in tensions or adding to an escalation of tensions in the region, but then we see it taking out airstrikes on Yemen, in Iraq, and in Syria. All it goes back to its defense of genocide in Gaza, if that makes any sense to you, Ryan. Your initial thoughts.
They call it a retaliation, but the drone strike on the U.S. base was retaliation for the U.S. supporting Israel in its genocide in Gaza and its mass murder in the West Bank. They're not supposed to be in El Tamf, Syria. They're not supposed to have bases in Iraq either, and they've strong-armed their way into having a base in Jordan. And then the U.S. attacked people who are not responsible for the drone strike. They just generically blame it on Iran or say Iranian proxy forces and then declare that any Shia militia doing anything are all the same, and so we can just go and kill those people. These are the people fighting the Daesh terrorists in Syria, in Idlib, and in Afrin.
Right, but Ryan, when you proclaim that you're not looking for tensions, I mean, don't your actions at the slightest, at the least, have to somewhat back up that proclamation?
Well, again, they're not looking for tension, but why did they bomb 11 different waves into Yemen? Because Yemen is putting up a blockade because of Israel's genocide. It all goes down to Israeli interests. This is not in America's interest to bomb Iraq or Syria or threaten Iran or bomb Yemen. This all comes down to Israel. And Joe Biden said it's retaliation for killing an American. No one can attack and kill Americans. Unless they're Ukrainian. They murdered Gonzalo Lira, tortured him to death. The State Department and the presidency hasn't said a word about that. He was American. That didn't matter.
And do you think that the U.S. is prepared, Ryan, to basically get itself embroiled in regional conflict because of the Israeli regime and the decisions it makes, its actions, and its war crimes in Gaza?
Their entire Middle East policy is because of Israel. They invaded Iraq twice. They had a long proxy war against Syria and set up bases there. They helped the annexation of Rojava by the Kurds. All of America's Middle East policy serves Israeli interests. They lost trillions of dollars, thousands of soldiers, clout around the world for nothing, on lies. All these wars are based on lies. There were no WMDs in Iraq. Assad did not gas his own people. None of these things were true, but they do it because Israel has such a strong hold on America. The U.S. is subsidizing its own subversion by giving billions of dollars in foreign aid to Israel, which is recycled to the donor class to bribe Congress and the president to do its bidding. And that cycle needs to end. They are not looking to de-escalate. That's what they say. They are looking for any pretext and excuse to go to war with Iran that they can. And if they do that, they will lose because they're not prepared to go to war with Iran. They can hardly take on the Houthis or Hamas.
And you know, the alternative to all of this, Ryan, is to push the regime and to stop killing children in Gaza. Why is that such a far-fetched idea for Washington?
Washington is the same group that killed over 500,000 people in Iraq from sanctions and starvation. That's many Gazas in a row. Now, of course, Iraq's a lot larger than Gaza, but percent-wise, it's the same thing. Children dying unnecessarily. They created a famine. Israel is creating a famine. They're blocking U.S. aid. They're blocking the UNRWA. And when Belgium refused to do that, suddenly their offices in Gaza were bombed by the Israelis. And America will follow Israel and do whatever it says. Netanyahu went to the Congress during the Obama regime while he wasn't there and got 55 standing ovations. That's who rules America.
All right, stay safe, Ryan. Thank you for joining us for talks on this bulletin. Ryan Dawson, their geopolitical analyst, joining us from Osaka, Japan. Meanwhile, intense Israeli attacks on Gaza have been continuing now for nearly 4 months. In the latest spate of attacks, at least 100 people were killed across the besieged Palestinian territory. There were fresh air and artillery attacks on Khan Yunis. That's Gaza's main southern city, which has recently been the focal point of Israeli strikes. Medical facilities in Khan Yunis have been affected as well. Al-Amal and Al-Nasser hospitals have been under an Israeli siege for more than a week. And now the UN is warning of a serious shortage of oxygen at the two medical centers. After Khan Yunis, the city of Rafah will be the next target of the Israeli ground attacks, and that according to the regime's military. Rafah is located in southern Gaza and hosts hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians. UN agencies have been warning about the deteriorating situation in Rafah.
So I want to emphasize our deep concern about the escalation of hostilities in Khan Yunis, which has resulted in an increase in the number of internally displaced people seeking refuge in Rafah. In recent days, thousands of Palestinians have continued to flee to the south, which is already hosting over half the Gaza's population of some 2.3 million people. Most are living in makeshift structures, tents, or out in the open. Rafah is a pressure cooker of despair, and we fear for what comes next.
The spokesman for the UN Humanitarian Office also warned about disease outbreaks in Gaza. He added, there is simply not enough food, clean drinking water, or protection for the population there. The World Health Organization says people in Gaza are enduring unimaginable circumstances. They are exhausted, hungry, and traumatized. And UNICEF says at least 17,000 children in Gaza are unaccompanied or separated from their families. Says that Palestinian children's mental health has severely been impacted and almost all of them are in need of support. Over 27,200 people have so far been killed in Gaza since October the 7th, some 12,500 of whom have been children. Palestinians in Gaza are facing humanitarian catastrophe amid Israel's genocidal war on the besieged territory, which is now in its 120th day. Our correspondent, Moti Abu Musabe, earlier joined us from the Gaza city of Deir al-Balah with some details.
Yes, actually, this current situation is unimaginable, and no one can imagine how catastrophic the situation would be if the Israeli occupation forces managed to raid and attack Rafah city. Because even these moments, as we speak, the current situation is catastrophic by all means. And I mean that there is no safe place in Gaza for the 4 consecutive months since the very beginning of this onslaught. There was no safe place in Gaza, and this situation would become more hazardous for the Palestinian people, more catastrophic for the Palestinian people, because all areas of Gaza Strip would be under the constant Israeli bombardments. We are waiting for more Israeli crimes and massacres yet to be committed if the Israeli occupation forces actually translated their pledges to attack Rafah city into real measures on the ground. So no one can imagine how catastrophic the situation would be. And as you know, that since the beginning of this onslaught, the UNRWA and the UN and all international human rights organizations, they have been releasing appeals for the international community, for everyone else to interfere and to put an end to this continuous onslaught, because what we are witnessing nowadays in Gaza is a real genocide. We are talking about 2.3 million Palestinian civilians, 70% out of them are children and women. They are completely afflicted by this continuous onslaught. We are talking about continuous Israeli strikes without having any red lines. This is happening before the eyes of the international community, and the people here are literally living and experiencing a horrific nightmare that till this moment has no light at the end of the tunnel.
A senior Hamas official says a new truce plan to end the onslaught on Gaza is unacceptable and does not include a permanent ceasefire. Osama Hamdan said resistance movement will not accept the proposal for successive pauses in fighting. He also said that Hamas seeks the release of thousands of prisoners held in the regime's jails, including those serving life sentences. The multi-stage proposal has been drafted by officials from Qatar, Egypt, the U.S., and Israel to halt the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza. It also aims to enable exchange of Israeli and Palestinian prisoners. Meanwhile, Israeli troops have destroyed a defunct mosque in the northern Gaza Strip as fighting between Israeli forces and Palestinian resistance fighters rages on. Regime released footage showing its forces targeting an abandoned mosque in the city of Beit Lahia just for fun. The move follows demolition of the Israel University in southern Gaza. That university had authorities saying that Israel had occupied the campus and turned it into a military base and detention facility for months before blowing it up. The Israeli military has destroyed hundreds of schools and universities since launching its onslaught on Gaza on the 7th of October, killing over 4,300 students and more than 230 teachers and administrators. The Yemeni army says it's carried out yet another operation against military targets in the Israeli port city of Eilat. Army spokesperson General Yahya Sari says the Yemeni forces struck Eilat with a number of missiles. Army says operations are in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemen's vowed to continue its military operations until Israel stops its war on Gaza and ends its siege of the Palestinian enclave. The Yemeni forces have targeted over 24 Israeli-linked vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas in the past weeks.
Amid the Western aggression against Yemen, thousands of people gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to urge the Yemeni army to expand its naval operations against American, British, and Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. They also pledged to continue supporting Palestinians at all costs.
Our message to the forces of American Zionist aggression is that you need to stop killing women, children, and defenseless people in Gaza. God has blessed us with Islam, and we will not abandon our brothers in Palestine. The Westerners will see what we will do under the leadership of Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who does what he says.
Our hearts are broken over what's happening in Gaza, including crimes, starvation, and the siege
siege imposed on the people of Gaza. They want those who survived the bombing to starve to death.
Protesters also slammed the European Union's bid to send military forces to the Red Sea, aiming to protect Israeli maritime navigation. The demonstrators said this move will escalate the conflict, since the Yemeni army will have the right to add European vessels to its list of targets.
The European Union is America's plaything. They are indeed many countries, but they follow America's orders to serve American interests. We call the Prosperity Alliance the Suicide Alliance because they commit suicide when they fight us. And we will not change our position no matter how much they threaten us and no matter how large a force they mobilize to fight us.
Any European force that comes to the Red Sea will have the same fate as the American and British forces, meaning that they will become legitimate targets for the Yemeni naval operations and will be hit daily by the Yemeni missile strikes.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that U.S. attempts to seek help from China mediation to stop Yemen's naval operations show the failure of the U.S. and U.K. in their aggression. He also criticized Arab countries for exporting goods to Israel, calling it an act of betrayal as Palestinians starve to death in the besieged Gaza.
Despite the U.S. and U.K. airstrikes, people here insist that Yemeni naval operations should continue as long as the genocidal war on Gaza rages on. They urge their army to target the interests of any party that supports the Israeli regime.
And that brings us to the end of your news bulletin, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on December 27, 2023, a week before the birth anniversary of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her. This day is celebrated as Women's Day in Iran. It is wajib, religiously obligatory, to have female doctors. So it is important for women to pursue medical training until there is an adequate number of female physicians. Teaching is also another example of wajib kifaya for women. It is obligatory to have an adequate number of women teachers. Now sometimes this obligation may clash with managing a household, having children, or the resting periods and breaks that a housewife needs. Similarly, a woman's work hours may interfere with her ability to attend to the work at home. If there is a conflict in these cases, it is the duty of the country's officials to think about this. The number of these professionals should increase to the point where if a teacher is required to go to school 5 days a week, for instance, she should be able to go only 4 days without there being any lacks.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A another teacher should be readily available to substitute for her. It should be the same for medical practitioners. Therefore, in professions, managerial positions, fundamental jobs, and jobs that are wajib kifaya for women, the presence of an adequate number of women is obligatory. There should be no limitations. If a conflict arises between a woman's work at home and her professional duties, this should be managed in a way that ensures both areas are taken care of. Although, in my opinion, these two do not conflict with each other. I know women who have successfully balanced demanding social roles, whether it be academic or non-academic jobs, while also raising several children, and they manage to do both very well. Hence, these two tasks do not conflict with each other. There are two important points according to Islam's view. Women are free to be active in all fields, such as being active in society and politics, etc. However, this should take place while remembering two important points, which Islam is sensitive about. The first is the issue of the family, which I mentioned. The second is the potential dangers associated with sexual attraction.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Namibia has denounced Germany's shocking decision to back the Israeli apartheid regime in the South African-led genocide complaint before the International Court of Justice. The president of Namibia, Hage Geingob, expressed deep concern after Germany rejected the morally upright indictment brought forward by South Africa before the ICJ that the Israeli regime is committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Geingob said Germany committed the first genocide of the 20th century on Namibian soil and is yet to fully atone for the genocide. Germany was responsible for the massacres of at least 70,000 indigenous Herero and Nama people of Namibia between 1904 and 1908. Elsewhere, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has condemned Western powers following his country's removal from a major trade pact with the U.S. over alleged human rights violations. In a recent nationally televised address, Museveni said that such trade restrictions and pressures have no meaning because Uganda is a nation of wealth creators. Now we are asking, why are Western powers using trade as a tool to spread their decadent culture in Africa? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and you're watching Africa Today. This week, we're focusing on Namibia's statement rejecting Germany's decision to defend the Israeli regime from charges filed by South Africa of genocide at the ICJ. The second part of our program will be on how Uganda is defying Western powers that want to impose their decadent culture on the country. Stay with us.
Namibia slams Germany over genocide. Germany is among a few countries that have taken an unpopular and controversial decision of defending the Israeli apartheid regime from charges of genocide in Gaza. In response, Namibia's president denounced Germany for hypocrisy, citing a genocide that the Germans committed in the African nation more than a century ago when it was a German colony.
Namibia has expressed full support to South Africa's ICJ case against the Israeli regime and has called for an end of the regime's U.S.-backed genocidal war on Gaza. Now, during his New Year message, the Namibian president said the world cannot ignore the plight of Palestinians.
No peace-loving human being can ignore the carnage that is waged against Palestinians in Gaza. There, the war in Gaza is telling that there are two types of human beings, those who can be killed like dogs and those who are holy.
Well, for more on Namibia's condemnation of Germany's support for Israeli regime's genocide against Palestinians, we have contacted Parata Daniel, a human rights activist and a social justice activist. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mubarak, for the invitation.
President Hage Geingob of Namibia has expressed deep concern after Germany rejected the indictment brought forward by South Africa before the International Court of Justice over the Israeli regime's genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, first, tell us your opinion on this historic statement by the president of Namibia.
Yes, the statement that was made by the president of Namibia, Honorable Hage Geingob, on the 12th of January, states it very clearly that we are in support of the Palestinian people who are suffering at the hands of the Israeli regime in Gaza and in Palestine in overall. Therefore, the statement that was made, it emanated from the anger and the failure of the German government to recognize that they committed genocide in Namibia from 1904 to 1915. Germany has failed to recognize and speak the same language that they are using defend Israel at ICJ. So many Namibians, and including the president of Namibia, has find this as a very ironic statement that Germany has taken. For now, they've taken side defend the Israel that is committing genocide, similar to the atrocity that Germany committed in Namibia from 1904 to 1915.
The government of Namibia, in its statement, said that Germany committed the first genocide of the 20th century on Namibian soil and is yet to fully atone for the genocide. This genocide has been termed by some historians as the forgotten genocide.
Germany genocide in Namibia, some historians, they call it as a forgotten 20th century genocide. It's really unfair to see the current state of how Israel is basically committing suicide, genocide in the Palestinian territories. That speaks to the language to us, the Namibian people. It raises that anger again. It reminds us of the history of what the Germany has done in Namibia. And the Germany government has accepted, but that acceptance does not speak to the language and to the conditions of the Namibian people that were affected, more specifically the communities that were affected, which are the Nama and the Herero. Remember, 85% of the Herero population was exterminated, and half of the Nama population was exterminated by the Germany government by then, Otto von Trotta, who issued such a statement. It speaks exemplary to what currently is happening in the Gaza Strip, where the Israeli authorities are able to issue unparalleled statements that encourages genocide.
Germany is siding with the current U.S.-Israeli genocide on Palestinians in Gaza. Now, this has raised questions over its sincerity in its so-called apology over the Namibia genocide. Now, in your opinion, did Germany really offer a sincere apology to Namibia, or it was just a PR gimmick?
It's a PR gimmick to say this. So I will say also to say that the German government, the stance that they've taken, the apology that they offered to Namibian government or to the Namibian people, it was not a clear, conscious decision that the German government. So that emanates now, it resuscitates the anger in the Namibian people to say that, look now, the German government, which has failed to apologize and compensate for the genocide that was carried out in Namibia, now stands with Israel. So that shows how the history is coming back again to bite this nation. So that makes it very clear that these governments are racist by nature. You can go back in history. The Western governments are the ones that instituted slavery, wars, you name them. All this atonement that the human race has suffered for the past century, it all emanated from this government. So we are not surprised by the decision that the German government has taken to defend the Israeli government.
Leaders from the Nama and Herero communities in Namibia say former colonial ruler Germany is not doing enough to make up for the genocide it committed there in the early 20th century. Esther Mwinjangue of the National Unity Democratic Organization says Germany perpetrated the genocide and can therefore not make a just and neutral decision on reparations.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
From 1945 to 2018, the German government paid approximately $86.8 billion in restitution and compensation to the so-called Holocaust victims and their heirs. The same government wants to give a paltry 1.1 billion euros to victims of genocide perpetrated by the German colonial regime in Namibia. This supposed compensation is seen by many as discriminatory and a reflection of the racist nature of the German government.
Another genocide committed by Germany in Africa was in Tanganyika in present-day Tanzania. Nearly 300,000 people were killed in the country during the Maji Maji resistance against German colonialism. But Germany is not talking about reparations for victims of the Maji Maji uprising, while it supports another genocidal regime. Now, this is the same country that lectures others on human rights. Mr. Daniel, our last question. What's your view on these double standards?
Germany government is hiding behind the moral integrity or moral value of coming to defend the Israeli, of which they only recognize that. Remember, these states are in their nature, they are racist. One thing for them, they are racist. Because there is no way you can recognize the historical genocide by Germany to the Israelis, and forgetting the context of how they manipulated the historical context of the genocide that happened or that was committed in Africa. So this is very important that everyone else know that the German government and many of these Western countries, they committed during their colonial regime, they committed mass murder in the whole of the African context.
Well, indeed, it's a shame, but not surprising that Germany, a country that committed genocide inside Africa, is now supporting the U.S.-Israeli genocide on the people of Gaza. I'd like to thank our guest there, Parata Daniel, for his insight. We'll now take a short break before our next topic on how Uganda is defying Western powers intent on imposing their decadent culture on these East African countries. Stay with us.
Uganda defies Western pressure. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni recently criticized the United States over the country's recent decision to remove Uganda from a major trade pact and issued trade advice warning about the risks of doing business in this East African nation. Following the enactment of a popular anti-LGBTQ law, the U.S. condemned the Ugandan government, claiming it was violating human rights.
The U.S. announced it was removing Uganda, along with the Central African Republic, Gabon, and Niger, from its so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act. President Museveni has consistently remained firm in protecting Uganda's cultural values and rejecting the decadent Western culture.
It's not genetic, it's not hormonal, it is a psychological disorientation where somebody, because of some experience, hates the people he should love and love the people he should not love. It's a type of like a sickness.
And to discuss Uganda's firm resolve to protect the country's cultural values in the face of pressure from Western powers intent on imposing their distorted culture, we have contacted Derek Kiyonga. He's a chief political writer at the Daily Monitor. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Following the commendable move by the Ugandan lawmakers to pass the popular anti-homosexuality law in May 2023, the East African country has come under pressure from Western powers to retract these laws. The Ugandan president has stood firm to protect moral values in his country. Derek, what's your opinion on this stand by President Museveni?
I think, it's quite interesting. My point of view is that I think the West must appreciate the views of certain countries. I think it's wrong for them to think that society should be at the same level. Because my understanding in Uganda, surely homosexuality is not welcome here. The Ugandans really have not at least accepted views of, or, you know, pro-homosexuality. So I think the West must appreciate that our society at least has not reached at that level of appreciating homosexuality. And this legislation is popular here.
President Museveni said trade restrictions and pressures have no meaning because Uganda is a nation of wealth creators. These sanctions are expected to be a trigger towards self-sufficiency in this country, also known as the Pearl of Africa.
I think that's where the trick comes, because the president is saying one thing and then another thing is happening. Because while he says that there will be self-sufficiency, the government continues to get loans, asking for loans from the World Bank, from Western agencies, from IMF. I can go on. So I think that's where the trick comes, because we have not seen real steps being taken for self-sufficiency, like reduction in government wastage expenditure. We have not seen that. So because if we are to self-sustain, there are certain steps we must take, including cutting on state expenditure, on how wastage, on the corruption, on everything. So as much as the president is saying that and it's music to our ears, there are no concrete steps that are being taken to ensure that government, that Uganda self-sustains, despite the opportunities probably we have as a country. But we are not taking such. Instead, our debt burden is increasing per day. So that's where, for me, the trick comes. I'm not seeing.
President Museveni says his country can trade with those people who respect Ugandans. As they say, every cloud has a silver lining. Addressing the recent non-aligned movement summit in Kampala, President Museveni said countries in this movement can enhance trade among themselves.
Since we are members of the same group of countries with similar interests, we should promote trade among ourselves. Because when I buy from you, I'm supporting your prosperity. And when you buy from me, you are supporting my prosperity. And we shall, I don't know how the Secretariat is organized of NAM and on the G77 to bring ideas of how we can promote and expand interstate trade among the NAM countries.
Our next question to Derek Kiyonga. Do you think sanctions imposed by the U.S. and other Western countries on Uganda can open new horizons of trade with African countries and indeed other countries facing Western sanctions such as Iran and Russia?
Even before sanctions, I think these are opportunities that have always been around. It doesn't have to go down to sanctions because trade should, you know, as long as you have something to offer, I think they should always be trade among different countries because there are various interests. Of course, with the Western sanctions, the president has said they can look for other friends, can look for China, can look for Russia, can look for Iran. That has been said previously. You know, the president of Iran came here in Uganda. We have not yet, again, the issue of rhetoric is fine, because these are spoken words, but real steps. If Uganda say it's looking more to the east, what steps have been taken? What steps? Because I'm looking at concrete steps. Yes, the idea is there that we can trade more with other countries. Of course, if the West does not agree with our views on issues like homosexuality, of course I would definitely, understand why the country would look in a different direction. But even in that direction, how Uganda has positioned itself, has it positioned itself to take advantage of those new opportunities? For me, that's my concern, and I want to see real concrete steps in trading with different countries.
U.S. President Joe Biden announced last October that he was expelling Uganda along with some other African countries from a so-called special U.S. Trade Africa program. Now, he claimed that the target countries were either involved in gross violations of human rights or not making progress towards democratic rules. Now, Mr. Derek, why are Western countries using trade as a tool to spread their decadent culture in Africa?
Well, there is a saying in English that who pays the piper calls the tunes. So I think they look at the dependency that, you know, most of these countries in the global south have had over time, and they think that if we take away what we've been giving them, then they will align with some of these beliefs. I think it goes back to dependency, because our countries for a long time have depended on the West, getting loans, getting grants. You know, most of our healthcare system is funded by the Americans here in Uganda. So the Americans think that by the mere fact, but they've been funding our healthcare, they've been funding some of our security programs, so we must align even with their cultural beliefs, we must toe their line. So it's part of, you know, the dependency culture that if we are depending on them, then we must do as they please. So the issue here is dependency that really must be looked at.
The African Continental Free Trade Area is one of the flagship projects of Africa's Development Framework, Agenda 2063. This free trade area is expected to boost social economic growth and development and accelerate intra-African trade. In a nutshell, it would make Africa less dependent on Western powers in terms of trade and development. Wamkele Mene, Secretary General of the African Continental Free Trade Area, elaborates.
We're building a,
a market of 1.3 billion people with a combined GDP of 3.4 trillion United States dollars. By the year 2035, the AfCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AfCFTA market is estimated to be close to 7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AfCFTA.
According to the IMF, Africa is projected to be the second fastest growing economic region in the world. Now, if African countries are to accelerate intra-African trade, sanctions such as those imposed by the US on Uganda will have no impact, and African countries can prosper while protecting their cultural values. Now, Mr. Derek, our last question. What steps need to be taken to boost intra-Africa trade?
I think for quite some time, Africa has been missing these opportunities, even in light of what I would call Western bullying. I think a lot can be done to ensure that there's boosting trade on this continent mm. among African countries, because Africa has a young population, but there's a lot of impediments in terms of, cross-border movements of goods and people. Visas are needed. For example, moving from Uganda to most of those West African countries, it's very, very hard. So there are a lot of impediments, trade impediments. Here in East Africa, for example, trade has not been easy. We have the East African community. So we need to take away the trade barriers. We need concrete steps need to be taken. African countries need to get serious and get away from rhetoric and take concrete steps in trading among themselves.
Well, there you have it. If African countries take concrete steps to trade among themselves, they will no longer be vulnerable to Western powers that want to impose their immoral culture as a condition for trade. I would like to thank our guest today, Derek Kiyonga, for his insight. Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think. Goodbye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
It's about Sheikh Abbas Qummi. May Allah keep his rest in soul. Sheikh Abbas Qummi is the author of the indispensable book of du'as and supplications called Mafatihul Janan, that means keys to the heavens. He was a man of great piety and a sincere lover of the Prophet and his progeny. Such was his faith and conviction that one day when his son was very ill, he took a glass of water, and after mixing the water with his finger, he gave it to his son to drink, saying, "Drink this, my son. You will soon be better, because with this hand I have written many ahadith and traditions of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them." One of the senior scholars of Najaf once said to Sheikh Abbas Qummi, "My foot is constantly hurting me. Please pray for me." The Sheikh replied, "If I say I will pray for you, it's possible that my prayer may not be answered if I have uttered something sinful in the past. However, I will pass my hand over your foot, because with this hand I have written many ahadith of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, and inshallah, Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, will effect a cure for you." When he began to compile the mafatih, some scholars of Qom, the city of Qom, advised him to use his vast knowledge to write explanatory notes on some of the complicated books instead. "Are you just sitting writing a book of du'as?" they asked. He replied, "I will continue writing the mafatih, and I have dedicated its rewards to the soul of Lady Fatima, peace be upon her. And with her blessings, it will become mafatihul jinan, keys to the gardens of paradise." One day he was sitting contemplating in the graveyard of Wadi as-Salam in Najaf, in Iraq, where many great personalities are buried. He saw that some people had just buried a man. Suddenly, for a brief moment, the veils were lifted from before his eyes, and he saw angels descending from the heavens with whips of fire with which they began to strike the dead man. He started to scream and shriek in pain, but none of the mourners heard or saw anything unusual. There was a man sitting near the grave reciting Quran, and another was distributing dates and fruits, and another was weeping, but none saw what was happening to that man. However, the terrible sight that the Sheikh saw in those brief moments made him ill for one whole week.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from iRab English Radio. This is Zaidat Musavi, and what we do in this program is to talk about different religious stories and their moral themes and lessons that we as Shia are supposed to learn and make use of them in our daily life. Well, the story we just listened to is about one of the most famous Shia scholars who the Shia schools is so much indebted to. Hajj Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi rahmatullah alayh was the embodiment of abstinence and piety. He was second to none in the training of oneself, being aware of the religious laws, trying to follow the infallible Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in worship, obedience, caution in speech, and keeping every aspect of oneself away from the prohibitions. He used to give lectures regarding advice and admonitions, the remembrance of Ahlul Bayt, and conveying the traditions of the holy Ahlul Bayt. During these lectures, tears would flow from his eyes to the extent that they would moisten his beard. Sheikh Abbas rahmatullah alayh had extensive knowledge of hadith, and for this reason he is also famously known as Muhaddith al-Qumi. Because of his vast knowledge, Sheikh Abbas was often asked to write commentaries on the Kifaya and Makasib of Sheikh Murtada Ansari. However, his real interest lay in supplication literature. After a long and arduous struggle, Sheikh Abbas compiled a book that contained the text of and detailed instructions on supplications or du'as, salutations or ziyarat, and prayers for each day of the year. He dedicated it to the soul of Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam, saying that with her blessings, the book would become Mafatih al-Jannah. That means keys of paradise. And today we can see that the book can be found in essentially every single Shia mosque, library, bookstore, school and household. It has been translated in many other languages since then. And the English version is known as either the Prayers, Almanac or Supplications. That is, call on me, I answer you. Okay, dear listeners, let's go for a short break and we'll be back in no time.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRIB English Radio. We are talking about Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi or Muhaddith al-Qumi, rahmatullah alayh. And we just read a short biography of his life. And now we are going to expound more on the single details of the life of this great character. Well, an extremely pious individual, Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi not only compiled a manual of prayers and supplications, he actually lived his life by them. Ayatollah Bozorg Tehrani, which was a great scholar of Shia, writes that he found him to be a model of abstinence and piety and completely aware and practicing of all the religious laws and extremely devout in following the teachings and examples of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. In fact, when he compiled the Mafatih and took it to the publisher, he in fact brought it back and acted upon its various recommendations for the entire year before submitting it for publication again. That is a tremendous example of the concept of practice what you preach. Okay, well, okay, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed this episode. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We have a great scholar who his book is perhaps in all of the houses of the Shia, and that is a book of dua, a book of supplication by the name of Mafatih al-Jannah, the keys to paradise. It's a book of dua, and the author of this book, he's a scholar by the name of Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi. He compiled a book of dua that goes through the calendar. In the beginning of the year, what is the dua of this day? What is the dua of the next day, the month after, the following months? And he has compiled all of the recommended deeds and supplications and prayers that a person is supposed to do throughout the whole year. Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi, he wrote this book, he authored it, and then he called the publisher. He tells the publisher, I'm going to bring you this book, and please, I want you to publish it for me. So he finished the book, and then he goes and he hands it over to the publisher. And then, a while later, before the publisher,